Welcome to Fire Engineering Podcasts, where each day you'll hear a variety of voices speaking on timely topics facing the American Fire Service. The best way to keep up with fire engineering is via our free daily e-newsletter. Learn more at fireengineering.com/e-newsletter.
Welcome to Fire Service Court Radio. My name is Brad Pinsky, and for today's session, I am your host. And together with me on this very important session of Fire Service Court Radio, I have with me the esteemed Kurt Verone, the venerable John Murphy, and the honorable Chip Comstock. And again, I'm your host, Brad Pinsky. And the four of us are fire service attorneys representing many, many fire departments and EMS agencies throughout various states. And today's topic is practical legal compliance in a very disorderly time. As we all know, we have the COVID-19 virus, and strangely enough, despite the shelter in place and the fact that business is sort of slowing down in most or many parts of the world, my phone, and I'm sure just like my counterparts on this call, my phone has been ringing off the hook with questions about how do we comply, should we comply, what are the consequences of complying and not complying, what about new things we need to try out, and how does the law impact us, what will the ramifications be about compliance, non-compliance, deviation, etc., in these very, very difficult times. So the attorneys today are going to speak about topics that we've gotten calls on. And we want to make a couple of points here. First of all, we're giving you advice, as you know, on a national scale, right? So all of these are just general legal comments. Everything is going to be very specifically dependent upon your state. So please, as always, do not take what we say is 100% applicable to your specific situation. This is to give you some guidance. This is to give you some talking points and thought points, but the laws in your state are very much going to be changing, possibly impacting your specific issue. Moreover, as all attorneys try to tell their clients, the very specific facts of your issue is going to change the advice and the direction that an attorney might send you. So again, we're addressing general legal concepts to give you ideas to think about, but please consult an attorney in your area, especially because with all of these executive orders coming out from mayors and governors, everything's going to be very much impacted now, especially in these times, by your locality. So, Chip Comstock has got a list of questions that we've received from our callers, and he's going to kind of guide our discussion along, and we're going to spend about 5 minutes on every topic, and if you have any more specific questions, again, about any of these, feel free to reach out if you want by email, and certainly again, consult your local attorney, because that's really where you're going to get the best, most specific advice. So, Chip, if you can start us off with the first topic.
Well, before I do that, Brad, thanks. I think the other thing that we need to address is sort of the legal versus practical thinking about what's legal and which is what we're going to address, and then what the other consequences are. And for the person to best outline that dichotomy, I'm going to turn it over to Kurt Verone.
Thank you. I was just trying to get my wife to get the dog under control. So if you hear a dog barking, it's because I couldn't quite reach her in the interim there. But one of the things that's concerned me, like Brad had said, we're getting inundated with questions, both phone calls as well as emails, text messages, you name it, smoke signals. People are asking questions from all different angles. And one of the concerns, this is a genuine concern that I've got sort of globally, but it has to do with the interplay between legal issues and leadership decisions. And sometimes we can think that something, just because something is legal or because the answer is one thing legally, that it's the right thing to do. It's necessarily the right thing to do. And we really need to make sure that we draw a line with that. We can answer a question about whether something's legal, but we can't answer the question about whether or not doing something is going to be the right thing for your organization. And just to, may sound like I'm kind of just blah, blah, blahing, but here's a real concrete example. I got a call asking whether or not a fire chief could order firefighters to have their body temperature taken at the beginning of the shift, or whether ordering them to have their body temperature taken at the beginning of the shift violated HIPAA. And the answer to that is pretty simple. It's not a HIPAA violation, okay? But that raises, if you just look at it from that perspective, it's almost like implying that it's a good idea to take somebody's body temperature at the beginning of the shift. And that's an entirely different issue that has to be researched by each fire department that chooses to do that or not do it. So we don't want to say because it's legal, it's necessarily a smart thing, a good thing, a wise thing to do. There's a lot of other issues that kind of go along with making that decision. We can answer whether or not something is legal or whether or not something violates a certain law, but we can't necessarily say whether or not it's a good idea for you to do that. So it's important for the listeners to understand that. And just because we say that, you know, this is okay or this is not okay, that it's necessarily making the decision for you. You have to make that. You may have additional substantive research in that area before you make your final decision.
Kurt, and I'm going to ask you to sort of point out, given that example, so the listeners understand, you know, you raised the issue about whether or not a body temperature should be taken, but then there's other things that might have to be considered that have nothing to do with a legal ramification. So if you could just give maybe one example of something taking body temperature that people may not think about.
Well, yeah, and again, I don't want to get into the, I don't think this is really I like to think I'm tactically competent, strategically competent, good in the street and all that. But I think each department's got to kind of figure that part out. But one of the concerns that a department may have is if they take the body temperature at the beginning of the shift, what happens if somebody tests high? Does that mean they're going home? Are they going home sick? Are you ordering them to go home? It raises a lot of questions. So what if it's got nothing to do with corona? There's a lot of issues that you want to think through. Just because something is legal doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. And I happen to think it's a good idea. I know Brad happens to think it's a good idea, but the point being, that's a separate issue from whether or not it's legal.
Well, and let's stay on that topic, right? Because one of the things, speaking legally, that we always hear is, oh, you can't do it, it's HIPAA. Let's make some very clear comments. What's that?
HIPAA hysteria.
Oh, my God, yeah. And let's make some very clear comments about HIPAA, because people have butchered HIPAA to no end. HIPAA is a privacy law, federal privacy law, that applies only when an entity engages in billing the federal government for claims. HIPAA does not apply as HIPAA, not to say there are other privacy laws at the state level, but HIPAA does not apply to any agency that does not engage in electronic billing. Now, yes, there are other privacy laws, but to say HIPAA brings out so many other, you know, the notice of privacy practices and record maintenance and record retention and disclosure, all of that. And people have to stop that. Every state probably has their own privacy law, right? Now, I will tell you, in New York State, speaking of this screening, right? In New York State, everyone's like, oh, the results of my physical are private. Well, as a general statement, maybe that's true, but employer-mandated physicals, at least in many states, again, we don't want to make general absolute comments, but in many states, employer-mandated physicals are not confidential. The results are not confidential. Now, again, even that's a broad statement, right? So with that, yes, maybe what disease you have is confidential, but whether you pass or fail a physical, the results of the physical, is not confidential. So everyone likes to throw around these blanket statements about HIPAA, but frankly, they don't know what they're talking about. So no, you have to look at...
Just in terms of what the advice I gave to my client on that very issue, I said, look, I said HIPAA doesn't dictate whether or not you can take an employee's temperature at the beginning of the shift. That's not a HIPAA issue. However, how you handle that information could, and I'm not saying it does or doesn't, but it could. But that's a separate issue. HIPAA doesn't dictate what questions you can ask or how you operate. But it may it may impact some of the data that you collect. That's a whole separate analysis.
But Kurt, your topic, sorry to kind of step on shift for the moment, but it leads us to a great, 5-minute topic. And one of the things, as the session for this, the topic for the session, practical legal compliance. And one of the things that's happening, because I would tell you what I would do, and I've advised many of my clients, they're like, well, what do we do with our volunteers? What do we do with our employees? How do we quarantine people? And I said, listen, with your employees, if they're unionized in the fire service, that's highly likely, maybe not on the EMS side, but we have mandated topics of negotiation and bargaining. And one of those mandated topics is shifts, duration of shifts, when the shifts are, not necessarily when you're scheduled, but certainly what the shifts are. What are the hours and conditions of that employment? And for example, if you have a 12-hour shift and then you come off and there's another 12-hour shift and then you come back on, right? The risk of infection every shift change is dramatically higher. Whereas if you went to a 24, a 36, a 48-hour shift, and we're not suggesting any specific shifts, if you turn over the personnel less frequently right now, you will significantly cut down your risk of crew-to-crew exposure. And just for me, I have been advising my clients that if you can work out without violating the CBA or bargaining agreement, if you can work out a change in the shifts for the next month or so, so we cannot, if shift A sees shift B and infects them, and shift B sees shift C and infects them, we're going to have no other, no one left in the department. So I think we have to take some dramatic means. And that's where I'm going to turn over the question, Kurt, Chip, John, is, okay, you have a collective bargaining agreement, which has, negotiated and worked out in contract some mandated topics, such as what are the shifts, right? And maybe it's what happens if you, fail a physical or test positive for something or whatever today, or what if you're sick? How much notice do you need? What are your rights if you get sick, from something on scene or unrelated? What should we do today? Here's my question, because this is what Kurt really brought up for our listeners. What should we do today to address practically the world of, and let's start with this, the collective bargaining agreement? What is the practical legal answer? I'll just throw that out.
It has to be negotiated. I'll tell you, that's a soft toss question. It has to be negotiated. I represent labor unions. It has to be, because anything that impacts wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment has to be bargained.
Let me ask you this. Let's assume that I'm the fire chief, and let's assume we all agree with your answer. And I think we would, but what happens when I'm the chief and I say I'm switching from 12-hour shifts to 24-hour shifts, and the result is and I tell them that if you don't follow my advice, you're going to be subject. If you don't follow my order, you're subject to discipline. And isn't the general rule that you, if the chief orders it and you believe it's a violation of a CBA, you have to follow that order until such time as it's been determined that that is an unfair labor practice.
And that's correct. But that would be the first move, is to go to the state labor board and ask for sanctions against the chief. But why even go there? I mean, if it's such a great idea, I mean, I'm a believer that if you bring a great idea to the union, they're gonna say, yeah, you're right, let's do it. And, you know, as opposed to heavy-handed, we're doing this, and if you don't like it, go find another job. Now, I know there are states that don't have collective bargaining, and the chief has the legal authority to do that. But, you know, I think that the chief obviously used to be a firefighter. If he could just put himself back in the shoes of being a firefighter again, having that ability to at least bargain over it and deal with some of the other issues, maybe a department that you normally works 12-hour shifts that's going to 24 doesn't allow firefighters to shop. Maybe one of the bargains might be, hey, we're going to allow them to shop because they're going to be in the station longer. You know, or just any of those little things, it is just going to lead to a more a productive workplace, a better work environment, more highly motivated people, in my opinion.
We're out here in Washington, the epicenter of this whole dang coronavirus thing. The Washington State Council has put out several memorandums guiding how labor groups should address this issue because it's a extraordinary circumstance that may lead to cross-staffing from one department to another, which again, that's bargain for work. And I know that years ago, the labor groups used to go crazy when we were trying to fill in paramedic programs or firefighter programs to supplement staff. And they said, well, you can't do that because it's a bargaining or a negotiable aspect of our contract. I think, you know, in extraordinary times that we are seeing now, we're going to have to do extraordinary things. And I agree with what Kurt and Chip and Brad are saying, is that we need to do the right thing. And we'll let the chaff and the wheat fall by the wayside as this whole coronavirus pandemic sorts itself out. So I agree with Kurt. I think that the state labor councils, in my experience, especially over the last month or so, have been very permissive in allowing organizations to sort of not bend the rules, but to make accommodations in order to provide the staffing that's necessary to make sure the health of the employees, that they're healthy. The temperature taking thing is, I think, one of the things that we're seeing in the medical industry, like nurses and doctors coming to work. I think we've taken that best practice, be a best practice.
So while we're, let me see if I can throw out another topic, because I got it. And while we're on the labor issues, I know we have other issues, but while we're on labor issues, and Chip, maybe after this, you can guide us with more that are on our list. But I got an amazing call the other day. Now, this is going to be somewhat state specific. But Kurt, you know, I'm sure Kurt's seen this in other states, but in my state, in New York State, there are a number of fire districts, municipal entities, and they, for some reason, are adverse to hiring an EMT as a civil service title, ambulance worker, whatever, or a firefighter. And we have many departments in upstate New York and downstate New York where they don't want to hire firefighters and recognize they're truly firefighters. So they give them these names, caretaker, houseman, right, janitor. And forgetting all the other issues at the moment, why I'm so opposed to this, what these places do is they say, well, we're going to hire you as a whatever, caretaker or janitor or houseman. And when the call goes off, you can volunteer and leave work and go to the call. Now, forget, again, the million other reasons it's a bad idea. The governor in New York State, as we've seen in other cities, other states, California, Illinois, et cetera, and this is going to be almost nationwide soon, if not already, we're going to see jobs shutting down, right, by executive order of the municipality. And the executive order in New York and California, and I think Illinois, is that only essential job functions can go to work. And employers have to close down and let all non-essential employees go home. Well, here's the problem. No one disputes that EMS, EMTs, firefighters are essential. but a janitor may not be. And when you've mislabeled your people in this time, you've mislabeled them as janitors and housemen and caretakers, they very well may be non-essential personnel. So we've taken someone who's truly a firefighter and saying, sorry, you're a janitor, go home. And how are you going to justify that you kept a janitor here, right? When, in truth, again, he's not a janitor. Now, my brilliant wife had a great idea as I'm giving this advice, and she says, well, the janitor, I suppose, can clean and disinfect everything in the firehouse. And that's a good idea, I suppose. I don't know if that makes you essential under your various state executive orders.
But Brad, the janitor is also a volunteer firefighter, if I understand the way that it's set up. So if another volunteer firefighter could be on the road and out doing things, why couldn't that person be out not as a janitor, as a volunteer? So
he could, but you can't pay him. Yeah, right. You can't pay the janitors to stay in house. And that's what some of these places are doing, not just in New York. I know this is happening in other places. They're saying, well, you're a janitor, so stay around and we'll pay you as you staff the firehouse. Right. But now you can't do that. You can't pay them while they're staffing the firehouse because we're intentionally mislabeling people.
But here, how about this? The second thing, and this is one of the, goes back to one of the bad reasons. Let's assume that janitor has an adverse concern about responding to calls that may be COVID-19 related. And so now that the janitor says, you know what, I'm not going on that call.
Exactly. Again, and you can't force me because I'm a janitor, not an EMT. Right? Now, there's a million reasons this is a bad idea. That said, this is just one more. And I guess on this very short topic, I'm just urging everybody who's mislabeling their people, call them what they are. If they're a firefighter, if that's their primary job, if their primary responsibility, is driving an ambulance when the call goes out, label them what they are. There's a million other good reasons, but this today, with the essential people going to work and non-essential go home, it's one more good reason to be honest about what you're calling them. All right, Chip, where should we go next?
Well, you know, we've been talking about personnel and various items along those lines, and my thought is we stay on these, and I'm going to throw out any topics that might be for Kurt or John. We have the FLSA and FMLA, any considerations there that have been brought to your attention in those topics?
Yeah, there's a number of FLSA issues. That's probably the number one area that I've been asked on. And I did a podcast on my own blog on this a couple of weeks ago, and it's a hot topic, but one of the questions, let me kind of just dispel this only because I've gotten three different questions on the same thing, once the president makes a declaration, do we have to pay firefighters overtime? And it had to do with a misunderstanding. I don't know if somebody's out there, you know, saying stupid things in social media and, as often happens. But the bottom line is there's an impression out there that once the president makes a declaration, you don't have to pay firefighters overtime anymore. You can pay them straight time or you can expand the hours or whatever. That's crazy. There's nothing unless some sort of change comes down from the Department of Labor or the president suspends the FLSA for firefighters. The overtime requirements have not changed. So the firefighters are still entitled to overtime as if the president had not made a declaration. There is no, alteration of Section 207K or any of the other provisions in the FLSA. The other issue has to do with quarantine and whether or not a firefighter who is exposed on a medical run or just in the course of business is exposed and is quarantined either at home or in the fire station, is the employee entitled to compensation while they're either at home or in the fire station? And then does that compensation have to be for 24/7 for the duration of their quarantine or is it just their normal hours and other things? So very complicated. We could spend a half hour just on those issues alone. At the end of the day, there's not a lot of guidance on this issue. Are you hearing an echo, or is it just me?
I think it's just you.
Okay. All right. I was hearing an echo. I was hearing my voice sort of delayed by a couple of seconds. But the bottom line is a firefighter who is in quarantine, we don't have any cases on that. We don't have any cases on quarantine in the FLSA to begin with. All of the cases that we have about quarantine predate the FLSA. You know, my fire department, the Providence Fire Department, goes back to the, 1854 when we first went to a career department, and they had quarantine. It's in the rule books from the 1800s. There's issues about quarantine. So this was sort of a something that happened on a regular basis back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. But today, this is, oh my God, what are we going to do? And we've sort of lost that institutional knowledge about how to handle these things. And in 1938, the FLSA went into effect. In 1985, the FLSA applied to municipalities. So we're talking about a relatively new law that's being applied to a relatively historic problem. And we just don't have much between 1985 and now. There's been no cases on this issue. There's workers' comp questions. There's collective bargaining questions. But if you think about it, when someone is put in quarantine, they're no longer working. So there's an argument that can be made that they're not entitled to compensation because they're no longer working.
Totally the opposite side of that. Well, I assume you do too, but...
Well, this we're talking as lawyers now, not as normal people.
Correct.
I think it's incredibly unfair. I think it's incredibly unfair not to pay the person, but we're talking about what is the FLSA requires, and the FLSA says you only have to pay somebody when they're actually working. Now, there's also an argument that could be made that if your employer tells you to go stand in the corner for 2 weeks, 24/7, and go stand on your head in the corner for 14 days straight, that the employer has to pay you because they're ordering you to do that. So, again, we don't have any cases on this. And I want to just point out the two, polar extremes there. You don't have to pay them at all versus you're going to pay them 24/7.
On a fact-specific type of issue, it would seem to me that it may come down to also who ordered the quarantine. Was it the employer, or was it a physician, or was it a Department of Health?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But here's, I was going to say, the problem, I totally agree with that. The problem we have is if I get, it's always an issue, right? Oh, I hurt my back today. I can't lift. Okay, where'd you hurt it? I don't know. It could have been while lifting this piece of equipment. It could have been while I was working at home, right? But here, we don't really know where somebody may have gotten sick. So generally speaking, if you
That's a different issue. That's a different issue. Getting sick is different than being quarantined.
Well, okay, but let's go back to, listen, my wife has it, and I was just exposed to her, and now you walk into work, and you say to your employer, this is getting the fact-specific part, you say to your employer, my wife is sick at home, I'm showing off after my 4 days off, and I just want to know I've been exposed to my wife. And he says, you can't come in and infect us. You didn't get exposed on the job, clearly, and you're being ordered to stay out of work. I think that's a very different scenario than we just went to a call and I got exposed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm talking about a work-related quarantine where you go on a run, or you're in the line of duty, you get exposed to somebody comes to the door, and maybe you're not even an EMT or a paramedic, but you're at the door of a fire station. Somebody comes in and you're dealing with them, waiting for the ambulance to show up, and you get exposed in that way. So it's not even on a run, but it's somebody who comes to the door. But bottom line is, it's in the line of duty. There's an FLSA issue, there's workers' comp issues that may apply in other areas, but I think my scenario here is really based on line of duty types of exposures. Is the employee entitled to compensation? Are they entitled to workers' comp? Again, the other issue with workers' comp is, usually workers' comp requires an injury, well, the person's not injured, or an illness. The person's not ill. They're quarantined.
Not yet.
And we don't have any, a lot of departments don't have any provisions. for that type of thing, either in the collective bargaining agreement, in city ordinances, or personnel regs, or personnel policies.
And Kurt, the harder part of this topic is you've made some very, let's call it simple, right, because it's better for the radio show, simple conclusions. But one of the conclusions we can't make a lot of times is, where did you get exposed? Assume only for the second that FLSA comes down on the side of, okay, if you've been exposed on the job, you get paid for all consequences, working, not working, whatever.
Well, but, I'm not saying that.
No. I'm just saying assume for the second. I'm only saying assume for the second. If that was the case, right, that you could or should get paid while in quarantine, again, assuming for a second, the hard part is how do we prove the exposure? And I'm only raising the question, are we going to see huge bouts of employer-employee union fights and grievances when this is all said and done, where the employer says, you can't prove, employee, where you got exposed. Employee says, yeah, but it's more likely it's at work, even though I can't point to a specific call.
That's not the case. That's not the scenario that we're talking about, because we're talking about a firefighter has an exposure. The department, either from the ER doc or from the health department, says, I've got to quarantine you. So it's the department that's saying, well, you've got to be quarantined. It's not the firefighter coming to the chief saying, oh, you got to quarantine me. It's the fire department telling the employee, you're going to be quarantined. Now,
sure, but
now, if you want to talk a totally different scenario, is where a firefighter all of a sudden comes down with coronavirus and now is going to try to trace it back to a different issue. And there's an important distinction between these two scenarios because I'm aware that some insurance companies, I'll give you an example, an insurance company is denying coverage, a workers' comp insurer is denying coverage for on-duty firefighters who went on a run and were ordered to be quarantined after that. And using the same logic that you just made, Brad, that how do we know that they were actually exposed? Therefore, we're not going to cover that. So, it's a different issue, but it raises you know, both FLSA questions and also workers' comp questions.
Exactly. And just let's expand the topic for the I think we have 32,000 volunteers listening at this exact moment, even though we're pre-recording it. For the volunteers is very similar as well. There is a model, I'm going to use a New York term, but a model volunteer firefighters and benefit law that was released decades ago. I don't know what states have done with it since then, but the many, many, many states that offer the volunteer firefighters benefit, these are very similar issues, right? Because at least in New York State, the workers' comp board determines whether you have suffered an in the line of duty injury or illness, and determines, right, whether you should receive benefits and whether you've been disabled, temporarily disabled, partially, et cetera. And so how do you prove this? How does anyone prove where you got sick in many of these instances?
Yeah, well, I think it's a lot easier when it happened on a medical run or somebody comes to the station or there's some other work connection to a possible exposure. But at the end of the day, it's not a lawyer's decision. It's not a judge's decision. It's going to be up to the medical professionals, and they can battle it out in front of a judge. But, you know, you're going to have a doctor say, I think it happened there, and then is it more likely than not that it happened there or it happened somewhere else?
And you run into these same issues with respect to, just to expand upon the state workers' comp, we also see that with respect to various accident and sickness policies that are offered by many insurance companies, including those who specialize in providing accident, sickness, disability insurance for volunteers. And the issue has been, okay, you know, many of these pay for my time. If I'm either quarantined, they'll provide for my lost wages under their policies, or if somebody becomes ill, they will provide coverage in theory. And what those insurers have said is that it's on a case-by-case basis. So to your point, Kurt, that they're looking and they're going to look at some point, I'm sure, because they're likely to be inundated with claims down the road as to what evidence there is on a causal connection. And the other important issue that they've raised is that you have to provide a notice of that claim in a timely basis. So if you wait, you know, an extended period of time, which in theory prejudices the insurer's ability to investigate that, they may just say we're not going to pay based upon the failure to comply with the notice provisions under the policy. What I think it comes down to in every one of the circumstances that we've been talking about is that the employee, or in some cases the employer, must assist the employee with documenting that exposure and the potential and the facts that would give rise to the claim. Because at the end of the day, you're going to have the employee who's going to make that claim would have to be able to support both by factual evidence of the exposure on the job and then providing the medical evidence that it is in fact connected to the on the job exposure.
And you just used the magical words. Document, document, document. If you have a suspected exposure, document it. If you have, right, if you have a shift where you went to something, document it. We cannot emphasize enough, the four of us, document the heck out of any exposure. Bloodborne exposure.
Right, not just sending an email to yourself. What we're talking about is you got to get the forms, you know, through the process to the insurer in order to make sure that you don't give the insurer a defense, like what Chip was saying, that if you just maybe do an email to yourself, a document on a piece of paper, and the insurance company isn't aware of it, they can deny the claim. So you need to follow all of the requirements to make sure that you're covered and get the notice sent into the insurer.
Right.
And at least in New York State, the employee, right, needs to notify the employer. If the employer fails to do their duty, so be it. The employee is still protected. But employees, volunteers, individuals, again, the burden's also on you. Advise your employer. Let your employer know. Document, document, document.
I think in Washington, we're seeing that the worker comp group, at the state level anyway, is taking a look at the Corona claims as a presumptive process, as you know, the nature of your job, in spite of the fact that you may have contracted it from your wife or a friend or a family member. Washington State is taking a look at, is this presumptively a disease that's been contracted based on your job? But one of the issues, and I think one of you guys had alluded to it, is that there's a lot of third-party administrators to a worker comp program. And I'm not going to mention who they are, but there's two or three of them that are in the deny mode, even for legitimate on-the-job injuries, that it's a deny, deny, deny. And I think for those organizations that do have third-party administrators, your documentation is going to be very important for them. And also, I sometimes would advise, and I have advised injured workers that are kind of laboring through this third-party administrator to retain the services of a lawyer to help them and help facilitate their claim. So I think that, again, excuse me, the coronavirus is creating this whole worker comp fiasco, is that many states are taking a look at it. And I think they're going to deny it, because can you not prove exactly that you got the coronavirus from this patient while you're responding as an EMT or a paramedic or as a firefighter? So we're going to, you know, lawyers are going to be pretty busy, I think, over the next several years to unravel this knot.
Hey, before we move off this topic, I wanted to just get one regulation for the FLSA out there, just so people, if they want, have more questions about overtime issues or compensation or compensability of medical treatment, et cetera. The regulation is 29 CFR section 785.43. 29 CFR 785.43, called medical attention. I'll read it to you quickly. Medical attention, time spent by an employee in waiting for and receiving medical attention on the premises or at the direction of the employer during the employee's normal working hours on days when he is working constitutes hours worked. Okay, so a lot of sub-issues in that section, but that is really the only guidance that we have, both for the requirement that an employer pay an employee while they're seeking medical attention. There's a question whether or not someone who is ordered to be in quarantine is actually waiting for and or receiving medical attention, but a couple of sub-issues. Two cases that I think are the leading cases in this area, Sheehy versus City of Aurora, Illinois, it's a 2005 case out of the Seventh Circuit, and then Copeland versus ABB Inc., 2008 case out of the Eighth Circuit. So for the legal eagles out there, it's a little bit of research data that you can use to kind of follow up on that issue.
Yeah, you know, but again, from a one of the interesting things from my perspective, as you cite that code section and or CFR section, and then talk about there's two cases. When you think about this from a national standpoint, while we have some guidance, and that's often the case, it's interesting to me that you have we don't see. Well, it's not. I guess it's practical that we just don't have a lot of cases. I mean, sometimes we have no cases, but there isn't, in the general scheme of things, as you've already said, not a lot of guidance. There's, you know, if you're not in two of those circuits, then you're, you know, they provide some instruction, but they're not, you don't have to necessarily follow them. And again, even then we're going to say it's on a case by case basis, just given all the scenarios. Yeah,
the only thing close to this was Ebola. And, yeah. We did have some quarantining. I've been in touch with the fire department that did quarantine, and, some put the people on workers' comp, their workers' comp coverage kicked in. I could tell you other fire departments just paid the firefighters 24/7 for the entire duration. Only because I think Ebola was such a it was such a big issue, and there was a decision made, you know, a political decision made. So, and I think I'm going to have to leave in a second on a run, but I think that there was politically it was advantageous for them to just handle it that way rather than be in the newspaper over it. So, but with that, guys, I'm going to have to take off. Okay.
All right. Very good. Yes, Kurt. Be safe.
All right. Well, it's unfortunate that Kurt had to leave, but that, as we all know, is the way of the firefighter who's called to duty and puts service to the community first. So wishing Kurt luck on his run. We'll finish up, I think, with one topic I'd like to throw out under the labor issues, and that is what is the situation when a career department states to its members, to its employees, that they cannot provide services, EMS and or fire, to a volunteer or part-time department? In other words, they are restricted as to what they can do when not employed.
Yeah, and to start off, as you may know, I was a fire chief for 4 years, represented a combination or worked for a combination department with a union. And it was, although my firefighters didn't adhere to this, the IAFF, it's not so secret, right? The IAFF encourages its members not to volunteer for a department while being a paid employee. And now some people say, no, that's too broad a statement. The IFF encourages, it's my word, their paid employees not to volunteer in a combination department. So maybe a little less restrict in order not to take jobs away. But I think, Chip, where I have heard this come up has been not in the broad brush, okay, we just want to protect jobs. In some sense, I've heard this come up from paid employees and volunteer departments, et cetera, where we don't want you to go get sick in a department which has fewer protections and protocols in place and then come into our department where we're being very protective and cautious and, you know, you get sick that way. And I've gotten that call. I've gotten, you know, we have part-timers. Here's an example. We have part-timers who work in a city and they come and do overtime for our department and we want to ban them. Well, look, part-timers generally have no protection in most places. They aren't, especially they're per diem. I should use a correct term. They're per diem, not part-timers. They get shifts when they're granted to them. They have no right to shifts. And in that case, look, you're not violating any rights. I believe Kurt would probably join with me on this. You're not violating any rights by not giving a shift to somebody who doesn't have a right. But you've raised also the opposite question, right?
Correct.
Can we stop you, right? Can we stop you from going somewhere? And I got to say, I think that would violate a number of state and federal provisions. I don't think you can restrain your employees in many instances, unless it's a CBA issue, from going and gaining outside employment. And places try to do this, like with, you can't work for a competitor, right? But I think we would have, even in these extreme times, there would be significant challenges to saying, you disciplined me for working outside, in some outside employment, even in the same industry. I think you would, and there have been these cases. I'm certainly well aware of them in New York, and I think, I'm sure there are some FLSA claims that say you can't restrain me from working outside.
And I think you're right. It comes down to often, because again, we're talking typically the restraint of full-time employees. And the question was raised to me by a chief of a combination department who relies on part-time employees in addition to his full-time employees. And many of those part-time employees work for other career departments. And so, you know, he was concerned with that another full-time employer was going to say, my employees can't work someplace else, and therefore his labor pool was going to be restricted. And, you know, one of the things that can come up, and I think that this is sort of the practical side, getting back to the very beginning where Kurt had talked about, is that's great. Every chief starts restricting their employees and where they can help out. And when those departments start, because, you know, you're the chief who restricted the employees from going elsewhere, but your department, for whatever reason, happens to run low, and now you have to start on employees due to exposures. And now you're going to look to some of the other departments for assistance under mutual aid. You know, they may not be as inclined to expose their employees to your community at that point. And so there are other ripple effects that could happen, but that gets back to the very beginning of this podcast where we talked about there's the legal answers and then there's is it the good or bad answers? And that's where, you know, you really have to think all the decisions out, both from a legal standpoint, but from a practical standpoint as well.
I think the other thing, just if I can weigh in on this a little bit, there's some agreements that departments have either through their collective bargaining agreement or in those at-will situations where the organization has created a document that people who come in have agreed to abide by the rules of the organization. And especially as it deals with second jobs, as an example, or second employment opportunities. And the agreements would usually outline the request by the either the employee or the volunteer that, can I work for another agency in the same capacity that I'm doing currently, or for some of the career departments with collective bargaining agreements, is can I have a second job as a contractor or as a construction manager or those sorts of things. So I think, you know, we kind of need to look back at agreements that organizations may already have in place before you make these sort of broad declarations that you cannot work anywhere. And if there's no mechanism in place, then I'm with you guys. It's probably hard to enforce this. You can't work for, you know, Department B as a volunteer or, you know, or have two career jobs as a firefighter, which I've had a couple of my firefighters that worked in two different departments. And so, which was crazy to me, but the labor groups basically took care of that problem. But I agree. I think, what we're seeing today is, we're trying to preserve our workforce from unnecessary exposures. But as we said earlier in the show, was I exposed to friends or family or a spouse, or when I was out grocery shopping, somebody coughed or sneezed on me, or I touched the door handle and now I'm sick. And so, I think we need to do the right thing for our employees. I say that the legal issues will shake out after time or over time.
Yeah, and again, my kind of closing comments on all of these, and it works here well, just to kind of wrap this up a little, is if you wouldn't do it, if it wasn't legal, if it wasn't right, if it violated the CBA, for whatever reason, if you wouldn't do something in non-emergent times, then the question is, how can it be legal now? And I agree with something that Kurt and Chip opened up with, which is, we want to do the right thing, but let's start with, is it legal or is contractually bound, et cetera? And if you're going to violate that, I would, on the contractual, it's easy. Get union consent, get employer consent. It's easier to get consent than just go ahead and violate it. But if you're going to violate the law, you better be on pretty sound footing, which is very different than it's unclear what the law is, right? As Kurt was saying, the FLSA and the issues of quarantine due to, an infection, no possible infection. We're in new territory here. So it's one thing being in new territory and taking the best advised guided action. It's another thing just blatantly violating the law. So I would strongly urge that we can't violate the law. If you need an executive order from your municipality or even your governor, go get one. They're being handed out like candy these days, right? Which will be our next discussion of bidding, next time we get back, bidding and purchasing and open meetings laws, which will be a great, great session when we do those. But let's be smart about it. Don't just violate the law because you're panicking, I think is my ending advice.
Well, Brad, as you've said, thank you. And I know before you guys conclude this matter, I will give a little bit of highlights in round two. So we just finished practical legal compliance with respect to employment matters. And next time we're going to talk a little bit about some other operational issues. Those are going to include the refusal to transport patients seeking transport to a hospital under these conditions. The functioning of government, which would include, as you said, bidding, open meetings acts, those sort of things. We're going to talk in the same vein about functioning of the private fire companies during these times, and adjustment of rules within the department, such as fit testing, physical exams. And finally, I expect that we'll talk about the Ryan White Act and some of the HIPAA notifications, but it is likely between then and now we may come up with more topics because we're being consulted on a daily basis, if not an hourly basis, on all sorts of legal issues, and we try to share those issues and concerns with our listeners.
And then just sort of wrapping this up, we're living in extraordinary times, and I think that the fire chiefs and the firefighters and the communities are sort of receiving a lot of advice from a lot of different places. And I pity the poor fire chief today that has to take a look at, what's the CDC saying? What's the World Health Organization saying? What's your local government saying about response and quarantines and, basically locking down communities and states. And so I think what I'm hearing from all the participants is we need to do the right thing, but we need to take a look at all of the intervening forces that are creating a situation for us, not only as providers or as fire chiefs, but as lawyers, to kind of sort through have we violated anybody's legal rights? Have we violated anybody's rights to protection from, infectious or contagious diseases? Have we violated any sort of collective bargaining agreements? And I can tell you that of the departments that I'm working with here in Washington, they're all working together towards this common goal. Let's protect the firefighter. Let's protect the community. Let's do the right thing for the firefighters, for our fire organizations, and for our community. And then, you know, let's have a discussion. Because I think one of the things that we see is that people get sort of locked down into these silos, that by God, I'm not going to do this, or by God, you're going to do this. And that just creates this sort of havoc that we've already, that we don't want, because we're already in a sort of a distressed society today. So let's do the right thing. And I think what we're hearing from Chip, Brad, and Kurt is that we're attempting to do the right thing. As attorneys, we're attempting to do the provide the correct advice in a dynamic environment. And this is a huge topic. And so I think what we're going to do today is we're going to end this now. We'll put it out as version one, I think, of the Corona 19 legal and practical issues of how to approach your employees and how to comply with the law and how to ensure, you know, the safety of your firefighters in your community. And we'll have version two that Chip, I think, and Brad adequately outlined for our next show. So any further commentary from my remaining audience here?
Well, first of all, big shout out to our biggest fan, my mother, right, who is would have called in, but obviously we're not doing a live show at the moment, but she did try to listen to our last one, and she's hunkering down in Florida. So my best wishes to all of our listeners. You know, it's hard to deal with legal issues at a time like this, but frankly, I got to tell you, the health, secondary to health issues, legal issues is one of the are the biggest issues we're dealing with. So they are prevalent, and I really thought my phone wouldn't ring while everyone's kind of sheltering in place, and we're all seeing our phones ringing off the hook with these legal issues brought on as a result of something no one ever thought about. So kudos for people, you know, to everyone about thinking about legal issues. But I, for me and for all of us, want to wish everybody, you know, a very safe, healthy endurance of all of these times. And you know, God bless America, and we're really coming together, hopefully, as a society, and we'll band together as a society. And look, laws are the foundation of our society, and law and order are important to our health and safety. So kudos to everyone for thinking about these practical legal issues.
And from Chip, I'll say amen.
Kurt. Well, in that case, on behalf of Kurt Verone, John Murphy, Chip Comstock, and myself, Brad Pinsky, I wish all of our listeners very safe, healthy times. We look forward to the second segment, and we will join you soon. Thank you to Fire Engineering. Our best to Bobby Holland, Diane Feinstein, and the Fire Engineering staff. And to all of our listeners, we say thank you.
Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.